from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, you may know Betty Reed Soskin as the oldest full-time national park ranger, whose talks at Richmond's Rosie the Riveter Museum frequently sell out. But that's only one chapter in Reed Soskin's long and dynamic life as an activist, musician, mother, entrepreneur, and author. She joins us to talk about her new memoir, Sign My Name to Freedom. And before the end of the hour, we'll look at the new Black Panther movie and why Oakland-based writer Carvel Wallace calls it a defining moment for Black America. We get started after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Betty Reed Soskin's talks at the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historical Park in Richmond have garnered national attention and recognition from President Obama in 2015. Soskin shares the often overlooked Homefront war experience of African Americans, but it was a true journey for the 96-year-old Reed Soskin to validate her own personal experiences, a journey she chronicles in her new memoir titled Sign My Name to Freedom. In this hour, we'll talk with her about what she's called her extraordinary, ordinary life. And so she is not speaking in her park ranger capacity, I should note, or on behalf of the National Park Service. She joins us today as a private citizen. Good morning, Betty Reed Soskin.
Thank you very much.
And welcome back to Forum. I remember when you spoke to Michael in 2015, many listeners said you should write a memoir.
And that I've done.
Yes, and now you have. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like we should just start at the beginning. Your family roots are in New Orleans, but you were born in 1921 in Detroit.
Yes, that's
why in
true.
Detroit?
That's true. It's one of those stories that Isabel Wilkerson tells about in The Warmth of Other Suns. My father called a white man by his first name at a time where black people were all addressed by their first names, and all white people in New Orleans were addressed by their last names. And my family had to get my family out. My grandparents had to get my family out of New Orleans. And my mother was pregnant with my sister. And they were put on a train and went to Detroit.
Because his life was actually in danger for doing that.
Because his life was in danger for having done that.
But yet, even though you were born in Detroit, and you did spend 3 years back in New Orleans before the storm took you to Oakland.
Yes, we returned at the point of my grandfather's health failure.
And one of the things that I was struck by was that even here in Oakland, you very much had sort of a New Orleans life or a Creole culture life.
Absolutely. And I really, really am grateful for that because it gave me a base from which to move. And that Creole culture has served me well, I think.
Yes. Is that how you would say that you identify?
No. At this point, having grown up as a second-generation Californian, because I came into the state in first grade at the age of six. So I came up pretty much as a second-generation Californian. So the Creole culture was something that I sort of wore when it was convenient, but my California roots are the strongest part of me.
Yes. One of the things that you also write about was in some ways being Creole as a kid was a bit of a layer of protection from racism, though a thin layer. You're very keen to point out. And I found that even it was fascinating to me that you really became aware of racial prejudice, you say, when you went to high school, Castlemont High School.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What happened at Castlemont?
When I think the message came through to me was when I was in a drama class. I don't remember the teacher's name, blissfully. I was reading the part of Mary Omni in Winterset, Maxwell Anderson's play, against Eddie Castro, who was the romantic lead. And I remember that I loved that role and that I'd read it very, very well and was aware of the hush in the classroom as we were reading it and knew that it was coming off very well. And the teacher asked me if I would remain after class because she needed to talk with me. And I assumed that she was going to be telling me that how well I had done. And it was true that I lagged behind the other kids and smilingly went up to her desk, at which time she told me, you know, we both know, Betty, that you really read that part very well, but we can't possibly cast you in that role against Eddie because the parents would never accept it because you're colored. And that was a point at which I was hit blatantly with the racial racism. But it was curious that my response was, oh, of course. How could I? How could I have thought that? But I dropped out of that class and went into a class on public speaking, which is what I'm doing myself with my life right now.
Well, yes, the boy that you would have played opposite was white. And, you know, when you say that at that time you responded by saying, oh, of course.
Yes.
It made me think about also what you said about how your mother responded when you said you wanted to take French in
yes,
high school.
Yes, absolutely. Because my family was bilingual. My family spoke a patois of French. My mother had grown up in the Bayou country of St. James Parish. And it was the language that the family gossiped in. And it would have allowed me in the club so that learning French was something I really wanted. My mother said, no, Betty, you look much more Spanish. You look Mexican, so you probably... And I was the darkest member of my family. So that you really need to speak. And then that's when I realized, oh, if I was going to get a job, that I had to look like something other than me. So that the signals were out there, strong. They were in the culture. They were in the Bay Area. They were in the country. But they were not being questioned at that time.
And in some ways, I feel like it almost contributed to what you described as almost a naive notion of your great-grandmother and aunt, who were both slaves.
Yes.
Your initial notion of their relationship to their slave owner who eventually married your great-grandmother.
Yes.
What was that? What did you think that relationship was initially?
I discovered the relationship at a time about 20 years ago. I was doing family history at the Mormon Family History Center. And I ran into, on the microfiche, were the census of the days, and those people became very, very real to me in ways that before my great-grandmother, I had met her. I of course, knew her. But they were out there in the census. Among that, we discovered marriage license that married my great-grandmother's mother, Celestine, to the plantation owner, Edwin Brough. And I realized that they had, obviously, I had thought that they had been in relationship for 19 years because Celestine and my great-grandmother, her daughter, were both enslaved and owned by Edward Brough. So I assumed that that was a relationship that had gone on for 19 years because my great-grandmother was freed by the Emancipation Proclamation at 19. And then I was later to learn, when we received the papers from the War Department were written when my great-grandmother was seeking her widow's pension, she gave her father's name not as Edward, but as Sylvester Brough. And in the census, Sylvester was Edward's older brother. Well, then we realized that this must have been rape, that this must have been that my great-grandmother was a result of that, but that later the younger brother, Edward, had married Celestine, became the father legitimately, and they did that in 1863.
The reason I bring up that story is because I feel like in some ways it encapsulates what were many moments in your life where you have a certain notion of something that's very innocent to some degree,
yeah.
right? And then you have these experiences that represent a certain loss of innocence. So this experience of this story and then realizing the story isn't exactly what you thought.
I think that's called growing up.
Yes. And there was a lot of that for you.
Yeah. I did a lot of growing up.
Yeah. You know, one of the stories I found so heartbreaking was when you did try a hand at being a domestic worker for a white
yes.
family. And I know you've said in the past that in your day there were like essentially three choices for women.
That's true.
To be a domestic servant, to work in agriculture? Was that what it
yeah,
was?
Yeah, to work in agriculture, to be a domestic servant.
Or to marry well.
Or to marry well, yes.
And so can you tell us your experience of being a domestic servant?
Well, I had assumed, I think, that when I graduated from high school, that I would have taken my place among the domestic servants because my mother did day's work along with my aunts. And I graduated from Castlemont, and the first opportunity that came through was someone who passed a job along to my mother, who passed it along to me, and this was to be my introduction. I took a position, a job, it was really, in a family that had just moved, and they lived just outside Mills College in the seminary area. And this woman had three children. She wanted a girl to be hired from Friday through Sunday. I did this. And because I knew that the going wage was about 50 cents an hour at the time, that this was going to be my windfall, I arrived Friday morning. I helped to unpack. I helped to scrub the kitchen and the bathroom on my hands and knees with a scrub brush. I took care of children. I helped with dinner. I helped with the three meals. On Saturday night, I stayed with the children while the parents went to a movie. The next morning, I was there as the family went to church. And I was all that time, I was adding up my 50 cents an hour, right? I was going to, and I had spent it many, many times over those few hours. And when the family came home, I heard the garage door. I heard the car come in. I was sitting at the kitchen table with my coat over my arm, waiting for the family to arrive in. The woman came in the door, and she came up to me, and she reached into her purse, and she said, "You know, Betty, I'd love to be able to give you more, but you know you're very inexperienced as a girl." And she handed me a 50-cent piece. And I walked out of the door and got on to a bus. Tears of disappointment running down my cheeks. Rode the short way from Seminary Avenue to 83rd, which is where we lived. I set the 50-cent piece down on the seat. Left it there, got out of the bus, and went home to my parents and never said a word.
We're talking.
That was my first act of protest.
We're talking with 96-year-old Betty Reed Soskin about her new memoir, Sign My Name to Freedom. We're talking about her many lives as a kid growing up in Oakland. And so that was your first protest. What would you say was the most significant moment where you started to say, you know what, the things that are happening to me are wrong and I need to stand
up for myself? The first hint of that, I think, was the first hint that this was bigger than Betty or her family or my neighbors was I was in middle school at Elmhurst School in Oakland. And in the moment of clarity, we were saying the Pledge of Allegiance, and I got to the line with freedom and justice for all, and suddenly went silent, and I must have been maybe 12, 13. I realized that that didn't mean me, nor did it mean most of the people that I knew, and it certainly didn't mean my dark-skinned Papa George, my mother's father. But I also realized that the kids around me didn't know that. That even the teacher whom I adored had no idea. And that there was something very, very wrong, but it had nothing to do with the room that I was standing in or the people who were around me. And I think that at 13 that I must have finally gotten the message that this was something much, much larger than myself.
I was struck by chapter 4 in your book, which was a very intense book. It's a chapter, it's called The Lion's Den, where you talk about the very visceral experiences that you had with racism, being the first black family in Walnut Creek.
Oh my God, yes.
And would you say that that was where you began to act on this political awakening?
I don't think I acted on it in my own behalf, because there was so much to deal with when it was me, when it was my family. But when I really came into my own was when a family, a young couple, who a truck driver and his, I think she was a nurse's aide, purchased a home in Pleasant Hill, not 3 miles from where our home was in Walnut Creek. And I read in the newspaper announcement of a meeting of an improvement association that was going to be held at Gregory Hills, Gardens Elementary School in a couple of days, of the improvement association to find answers to keeping that family out. And I decided that I had now lived in my area in the dilemma that I was in racially long enough to know that one gets over that, that my neighbors had gradually gotten through it, and that there was sunlight on the other side, and that maybe my duty was to go to that meeting and to tell those people that this was true, that you do get past this. And I did. I went to that meeting, and I could talk in defense of someone else in ways that I couldn't talk in defense of myself. But I did face up to that meeting. It was, I had told an attorney, David Borton, who is a member of the Unitarian Church out there. He called because I wrote a letter to the editor explaining that I was, that I had objections to this meeting and what I was going to do. David called and said, "You can't do that. They're going to hurt you." And I said, "No. They only say those things when they're out behind our backs. No one says that in our presence. And so I will go, and I will say my piece, and then I will leave." But I got to the meeting, and no one recognized me as being African American. And they went on with their meeting, and they said all the vicious things that they would have said without. And for the first time, I got to hear those things, because the people who were around me in my community were too polite to say that in my presence. But they would say those nasty things around their children around the dinner table, and that's what my children were being forced to deal with. But this was the first time I was to hear it. And at a point where someone said, "If we can't get them out, the undesirables out in any other way, we can use the health department on the basis of the filthy diseases they bring in." At which point I walked to the front of the room, identified myself, and told them in about a 10-minute spiel all that I wanted to say, and then in a panic ran out of the building and got into my car and took off for home. But that was when I grew into my adulthood. That's when I was able to deal with it.
Why did you experience a mental break? You were married. You had 4 children. Why did you experience the break, and what got you out of it?
I experienced that because I was so helpless in that community. I was trapped by in a culture that was without its men. All the women around me, the suburban women, were alone too. Their husbands were all in Oakland and San Francisco making money for the mortgage, as my husband was. My oppression was coming from the women. Our family's oppression was coming from there. I knew that I had a right to be there, that I had a right to provide for our children. I had given birth to a daughter who was brain damaged at birth, who functioned in the retarded range. I had 3 little boys who were all being subject to the viciousness that they had to go through.
Because they were one of very few black kids at their school.
Yeah. They were the only.
Or the only.
The year that we moved in, my third grader, who was our oldest child, was the only student of color at his school. That year, the fundraiser by the PTA was a minstrel show. And all of the teachers and the administrators were in blackface. That's who we were as a nation in 1953.
And all during that time, your oldest was struggling with his sexuality as
Absolutely.
Well. And eventually came
and
out
all of that caused me to, in the 60s, to fall into a mental break that lasted about 3 years. And because I was entrapped by the situation, there was no way to escape it except to go into myself. And it was that's when I found the artist in me.
Yes.
Into that.
What role has singing and songwriting played for you?
That was my salvation at the time. I found that I look back at those many tapes, reel to reel, that were made in those years, when I was singing, not really publicly, but in churches and sometimes on college campuses or with groups of poets or musicians. I wanted to sing, but I didn't want to be a singer. That was something that was beyond me. But now I have access because those tapes have all been digitized. And I'm now listening to my voice of 40 years ago.
Yes, I read that you, in your book, that you listen to your songs before sometimes you give your talks at the Rosie
That's
the
right.
Writer. Why? What are you listening? What are you doing when you're listening to your own voice?
Because now I'm in the process of bringing all of myself together. That by the time you're 96, you've been many, many, many women. And those are all being pulled together now. And they are being pulled together. Not only are they being pulled together through my music, but that music documented about 40 years of social action that were the years that I was not only living, but I was recording the times I was living in. And I do that because it brings a kind of coherence to my life now.
We're talking with 96-year-old Betty Reed-Soskin. You probably know her best as the oldest career National Park Ranger who gives very well-attended lectures at the Rosie the Riveter Museum in Richmond. But we're learning about the Betty before that. We're learning about the woman who came of age and found her voice. And if you'd like to join the conversation, if you have a question for Betty Reed-Soskin, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. On Facebook, you can tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Again, we'll have Betty Reed-Soskin after the break. Stay with us.
Monday morning, streets are bare. Seems as how they don't want me nowhere. Since I went to the courthouse and signed my name to freedom. Daughter say, mustn't run. Sound of trumpets, the kingdom's come. Mama, go to the courthouse. Got to sign your name to freedom.
You are listening to Betty Reed-Soskin singing the song she wrote, Sign My Name to Freedom. You probably were about 40 then, Betty?
I think so.
Wow, what do you want to say about Sign My Name to Freedom, which is the title of your book?
That's right. That song was written based on the letters from Susan Sanford, who's at that time an 18-year-old young Cal student, had gone into Canton, Mississippi to work in a freedom school with SNCC. The letter she wrote home gave me the ability to imagine the woman whose home she was staying, and being surrounded by the SNCC workers.
Well, William says, "Amazing woman, will you be our president?" Well, speaking of president, so President Obama in 2015 gave you a gold coin. Right?
Yes.
What was that experience? What did that mean to you?
That was amazing because I was carrying in my breast pocket a picture of my great-grandmother who was enslaved, and I was holding the hand of the first black president of the United States. And the history in that moment was so compelling.
And then I read just, I think, a year or so ago or a year and a half ago that you, your home, you had an intruder come in and severely beat up your face and take that coin away.
Yes, but it was replaced by the Secretary of the Interior, who got another one from the president, and it was given to me with a personal note from Barack Obama.
And you fought this intruder off.
I certainly did.
Oh, my God. And that experience has not just terrified you, or?
No. I learned in that experience that I could take care of myself.
Wow. Because I do know at one point you were quoted as saying you believed you were going to die at that point, that he was definitely there to kill you.
No, I didn't think so.
Oh, okay. Well, no, I don't know, maybe that was a misquote in the piece.
I was so glad that neither of us was armed, because I'd have been dead. Now, that may be what was being confused here, because he had my cell phone within 2 seconds. And if that had been a gun, it would have been true.
Well, Bill writes, "I saw her speak at Oakland Museum. She remembers entertaining soldiers from Port Chicago who
yes.
dined that night in the blast."
Yes.
You do write about this in your book, where because of the segregation, black soldiers were not allowed to be part of the entertainment for
No,
the
they weren't. They weren't welcome to USO.
So black families would entertain
We
them.
Would entertain the kids in our homes, yes. And I was only 20 and my husband was 23, but he was a playground director. Would gather up the young servicemen who would gather at San Pablo Park and bring them home on Saturday afternoons for lemonade and cookies. Yes.
You're still haunted, though, by the explosion.
Yeah, because I had no idea, because you don't learn people's names under the circumstances. And at the memorial, at the stele that's out there at the memorial, their names are listed. And I always wonder which of those kids wound up as unknowns.
Yes. One of the other things I just want to talk to you about is how you reconciled. I found this really interesting in reading your book, how you went through a moment where you had to reconcile your black and white worlds, essentially. You write about becoming part of the Unitarian Church.
Yes.
And through them being involved with the Black Panthers. Is that
yes.
right? You were a bag lady who brought money to the Black Panthers. very much a political activist. And then you were sent to a Black Power Conference?
Yes, I attended 3 National Black Power Conferences, one in Chicago, one in Cleveland, one in Detroit.
Can you talk about
that
your experiences
year.
There?
Well, after about the third of those meetings, I began to see rising in the Black Power movement many of the things that I was running away from in the general population, that they were simply being resurfaced and dished out again. And I felt not comfortable. I had flown into Detroit on a plane with Mrs. Walter Reuther without knowing that's who that was, until we got over Detroit and we had been talking along the way, and she mentioned that she had a car coming for her at the airport, and that since she asked me where I was staying, and I said the Hilton in Detroit, and she said that they would drop us off, me off at the hotel. And when I got into the terminal, the chauffeur paged Mrs. Reuther, and that's when I realized who I'd been riding with. And she asked if she could come to hear Julian Bond, who was scheduled to speak. And the Black Power wouldn't the conference wouldn't allow the Reuthers to be there because no one, as I am quoting, was more recognizable in Detroit than the Reuther family. And I began to see those kinds of divisions coming up. And on the way home, I wrote this song.
Would you like to share
this song? Yes, I will. And that was that I had spent years in the suburbs being not quite white enough, and in the Black Power Conference not being quite black enough. And I wrote this song saying, to each of me, to love within the reach of me, and if this love could teach to me why each of me, in turn, should torture so the soul of me and tear apart the whole of me. Within life's play, each role of me must speak to me, must learn that blackness and the white of me are just the day and night of me, and not the wrong or right of me. Can't you see there's got to be some answer to this planet's pain, my microcosmic world insane? If only I could make you see, it's here to see, just look at me. There is within me all of you, from distant lands, the whole of you, the dreams, the heart, the soul of you. If you would only see that black and white are part of it, my brown is at the heart of it, and blending was the start of it, and someday it shall be that blackness and the white of us will be the day and night of us, and not the wrong or right of us, the weak or might of us. Then we'll be free.
That's Betty Reed Soskin reading from her book, Sign My Name to Freedom. Mike asks, what is your opinion of the current state of affairs of African Americans in this country today with Black Lives Matter and kids and adults being gunned down? I would add to that the fact that, you know, you saw the inauguration of the first Black president. Now you see the inauguration of Donald Trump, which many see as a regression in terms of race relations.
I think I can answer that by saying that at 96, I've lost my sense of future. But in compensation, my sense of past has been enhanced, and that I now know that these periods of chaos this country has been going through ever since 1776, and we're in another one of them. But it's in those periods that the country is being redefined, and that's when we have access to those reset buttons. And that we're in another one of those now. It doesn't matter who the people are. What happens is that we have to get in and work because the democracy is being redefined.
Well, B says, I saw her speak along with several Rosies at the Rosie the Riveter Museum. They are quite entertaining and shared their stories of their lives at the shipyard during World War II. See them while they are still with us to share their stories. So you have said, I rarely spend much time in yesterday or tomorrow. There's always been simply now. And you've also said, what greater exit from this dimension than to simply disappear into the work of others? Do you find yourself thinking more about your death these days?
Oh, I'm dealing in the strange place where my life is exploding while I'm dealing with end-of-life issues. Mortality is really at the forefront now. I do deal with non-existence. That's a part of my reality now. And it's not a sad thing. I'm doing that with my children. I'm doing that knowing that I'm at the cutting edge of my existence, but that's perfectly fine.
Jason says, I really just want to thank her for being a role model and a great American. Jayan says, I'm sorry. Betty Reed Soskin, thank you so much for joining us this
morning.
Thank
you so much.
Betty Reed Soskin, her memoir is Sign My Name to Freedom, about her 96 years so far. We are going to be talking Black Panther next. Stay with
thank
us.
You.